It's fall, y'all. And there's got to be a t-shirt that says that, right? So it's, you know, fresh notebook, sharpened pencils, sharpened sense of ambition, excitement after the languid summer days, and of course, the glory that is decorative gourd season. You can say that with all the swears that you like, but I'm not going to hear falling leaves and Halloween, which means it's time for smoky, eerie, witchy reads, and I have just the thing for you, playing the witch card. Expect a woman starting over again after her marriage collapses, hampered by her magic-obsessed daughter, her flaky mother, her enchanted ex, and a powerful witch who's thrilled that she's back in town, and not for a good reason. To keep her family together, Flair has to embrace the hereditary magic that's done nothing but ruin her life in the past, and make it her own. I was inspired by what I see as the real magic of tarot cards, which play a huge role in this book, and tea leaves and palm reading, and honestly, every form of oracle. They're here to help us see and understand our own stories, which is pretty much what Flair figures out. And as someone for whom stories are everything, I love that. You can buy Playing the Witch card everywhere, and I hope you will do exactly that and love it too.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey kids, it's KJ, and this is the Hashtag Am Writing Podcast, the place where we help you play big in your writing life, love the process, and finish what matters. Today on the pod, I'm talking with Catherine Newman. She is the author most recently of We All Want Impossible Things and Sandwich, and also earlier in her career, Waiting for Birdie and Catastrophic Happiness, as well as two fabulous How to Be a Person in the World books for kids that honestly I think we could all benefit from. I'm considering just, you know, sending out copies. They are How to Be a Person and What Can I Say? That one's really useful. Okay, so now, just out, she has Wreck, which it kind of comes after Sandwich, but you could read them separately. They're both small, intense books. So Wreck, like all of Catherine's work, is inevitably about exactly what I just said. It's how to be a person in the world, which I didn't actually ask Catherine this. I'm recording my intro for y'all after talking to her, but she would not tell you she knows how to be a person in the world, but she is so fantastic about the part where we're all figuring it out and being aware that we're all figuring it out. And that's what all of her books are about. In the interview, which you're going to love, she calls herself the queen of the slight plot element, which made me laugh really hard and also made me realize that I think Catherine Newman is the modern Anne Tyler. So tell me what you think in the comments on the show notes, which you'd better be getting. They are at, there's no hashtag in our name, amwritingpodcast.com, or search anywhere. They will have the books that Catherine mentions and also all of your chances to do all of the things like have your first page appear in a Book Labs episode, talk to us, get in there, tell us what you're thinking about writing, write along with us, really just all the community stuff that we all so desperately want. Okay, here comes my interview with Catherine. I know, gosh, it was so fun to talk to you. You guys are going to love it. Catherine Newman, welcome to the Hashtag Am Writing Podcast, where you've been at least once, maybe twice. I need to go and look. It's so fun to have you back. I remember us walking in the woods before you had finished We All Want Impossible Things in 2021.
I remember it too.
Which actually, for three books, is not that long ago.
Hey, that's true. I know, I remember your dog.
He's here somewhere.
You had a young dog with you. It was the best. And you said so many things that I've thought about so much on that walk, but I don't want to derail the thing you
want
to talk about.
But same. It was a great walk. We must do it again. All right. Meanwhile, okay. So I already described in the introduction all the things you've ever written in the past and raved about you. So don't worry about that. You've been sorry you don't get to hear the petting. But the question is, tell us a little bit about Rec.
Yeah. So Rec. It's so funny.
I know. It's painful. Elevator pitch or whatever you want to say. Because seriously, I did just tell everyone about them in the intro.
I really need an elevator pitch. I feel like We All Want Impossible Things was like a woman whose best friend was dying while she like slept with everybody.
Yeah. It was joyful.
That was easy.
And also sad.
Sandwich was like Cape Cod for a week, reproductive mayhem, sandwich generation. Rec is so weird because there's these two sort of very slight plot elements. So it's, you know, a woman in her mid-50s living in a house with her her husband of many years, her daughter who's between college and grad school, and her dad, who's fairly recently widowed and in his 90s. And that's mostly what the book is. But the little plots are that she has a rash. She notices that she has a rash, and it inaugurates this kind of diagnostic tornado, a slow and quiet tornado, but a tornado nonetheless, where she has to see a billion doctors. She has to constantly check her patient portal to see if she's dying or not. And anyone who's been anything but healthy in the last 10 years will understand the patient portal experience.
Yes, I love the checker. I checked a patient portal from a hockey rink parking lot, and that's a mistake. Just FYI.
Don't do it on a Friday night.
Don't do that.
Just don't even look. And then the other plot point is that there's an accident there's a collision between a car and a train, and a schoolmate of her kids, like someone they went to high school with, is killed in this accident. And she becomes kind of weirdly obsessed with the accident. She looks at it online all the time. She stalks everyone's
Which
secretly.
So tracks for the character that you have created.
It doesn't it? And that's it. And so the book sort of is those things unfolding in this parallel way, these uncertain things.
So when you wrote it, what was your intention for this? What did you want Rec to be in your career and for your readers?
It's so funny to be asked questions about my career. I don't know what I wanted it to be in my career, but maybe while I'm talking to you, I'll figure that out.
Okay.
Or you can tell me. But for my readers, I do think we're in this funny place where some of us are hungry to read about the experiences of other menopausal women who are taking care of aging parents whose nests are emptying, who are in long marriages, who are, you know, doing the things of this age, including tracking weird illnesses. So I guess that, you know, I feel like the thing that I love about writing, one of the things is when people say to me like, oh yeah, I feel the same way about that. Or they write me and they're like, oh, I read this and I felt so relieved that I wasn't alone. And I guess I have a lot of that hope, you know, that it speaks to someone, or someone's been in their portal rummaging around and finding out horrible things about their health and Googling them. Like, that's not a small part of the population who's probably doing that. So I guess just that, you know, the handout, the I'm with you on this vibe.
So what do you love most about it?
I mean, that's a funny and embarrassing question. The father character is based very closely on my own father. Many of the things he says are verbatim lifted from conversations and texts with my dad. And I just love that character so much. I think he's so funny and has this kind of like deep wisdom. I mean, Rocky plays him for laughs a little bit, but he offers so much to her. He's still this really profound caretaking force in her life, even though he himself, you know, is failing in different ways. So I guess that's what I like.
How does your dad feel about you taking his stuff?
He loved this book.
I love this.
Has not felt that way always about the way I represent him. I represent him in Sandwich in similar ways, and Sandwich, there were just particular things that bugged him. He loved the book overall, but didn't love his character. I think in this book, maybe because there's so much of his character, that it gets to be a very well-rounded kind of person, and also somebody whose opinion it's obvious the other characters respect. So he really loved it, which was like everything to me, you know?
Yeah. Oh, wow. I give a lot for that. That's wonderful. No. I would. It's
true. I understand.
Although all my dad ever says is, why don't you only write about mothers? You never write. And I'm like, well, I don't know. Have you read some of the mothers? You're kind of lucky. You're doing okay, man. I don't know why. You guys were great. You should have been better fodder for fiction. And then I would, yeah. All right. So that's what you love about it. What was the hardest about this?
It's funny. It's a little hard to talk about without spoilers, but there's a difficult part of the plot that involves Rocky's son, who works for a consulting firm in New York, where she really questions his values, questions the decision to do that kind of work. And I found that is fictional. That is my son does not work for a consulting firm.
That would stun me, frankly.
However, he knows a lot about that kind of work and talked to me a ton about it for the book, like went on a million walks with me and let me pick his brain about it. And I really just found it so hard to write about this kind of painful conflict between Rocky and her son. I just found it really hard. Yeah,
obviously.
I imagined it.
Cool.
And honestly, my husband could hardly stand to read it. He found it so devastating. As you know, it's not massive conflict. It's like...
But it is.
But it is.
I mean, it's, you know, it's...
Yep.
It goes back to Alex Keaton, right? There we
it
go.
Goes
I'm
back.
Aiden and Kate, both of us.
Yeah.
No, I get it. It's a really... And by writing it, even if it's not autobiographical, which it's not, it's fiction, you are saying something about some compatriots, you know, some other... You're putting a stake in the ground, which I think has always been pretty obvious for anyone who knows you or has read you, but maybe you had not verbalized even in a fictional form.
Maybe.
Could feel judgmental. Because it's judgmental. But it's values. That's what values do. A value that doesn't judge anyone isn't a value.
And
even if you don't want to judge people. But I think it's kind of true. Like,
yeah.
You can also be open, but I mean, that's, I don't know. If you don't offer that up, then we're all just sitting here going, oh, it's fine. It's all.
Everything's fine.
Everything's fine. It's fine. That's a joke in our house because we had this Spanish exchange student and he would always say, oh, it's fine. It wasn't fine. Yeah, no, that's
no.
Inherent. So that's what it means when we say it. It's fine.
Oh my God, KJ. Yeah.
All right, so this kind of gets to, I think, my next question, which is, what about this was bigger for you, was a bigger leap to take in your writing?
It's like, you know, I think it's just a little more plot in a novel than I've ever managed, even though, you know, don't laugh because there's not a ton of plot. But nonetheless, there were sort of these two vectors of significant, I thought, dramatic tension that I had to manage in the writing. And I was anxious about it. Like I like a quiet story that's not like is too plot driven. But anyway, so that is, it was, you know, I definitely plotted it a little more actively before I wrote it. Like I wanted to make sure that these plots were unfolding in the time frame I wanted them to unfold in.
And did that present some new, like, oops, I did this too fast. Oops, I, like, just that you hadn't really had to.
No, because I plotted it. It actually didn't, but it just presented, before I started writing, I had the challenge of, you know, practically trying to graph these two plots to see where they would intersect and the sort of ways that the two plots together create this kind of character arc for Rocky, the main character. And so I was, I have this way that I plot stuff, and it's kind of based on that book that I use, Because of You, which is like, you know, put on your pants or take off your pants, or, you know the book I use.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I do this thing where I make I write down the numbers 1 to 25 and I print that. I print a piece of paper that has the numbers 1 through 25 in type font. I don't know why I don't just handwrite the whole thing. That, and I guess that that's how many chapters it's going to be, but it's never quite right. And then I fill in what I know. So I put in everything I know and guess where it's going to go in terms of the, what are the things, what's it called when it's like a
the turning point, the,
or the beat,
moment of last resort.
So I fill in everything. Like I know, you know, I have a sense of how it's going to open. I have a sense of the different elements of the two plots, and I put them in this weird numbered chapter thing. And usually, like usually, as if I've written so many books, but with the other two novels, I did that a little willy-nilly and it was fine. Like I sat down and wrote the books beginning to end without all of it totally sorted in terms of where everything would go. And that was fine. This book, I really had to understand where it was all going to go. So I had to just be sure that all of the most important plot points were plotted in that 1 through 25.
Do you, I mean, you have a lot of moving emotional pieces too. Asking for a friend, how do you make sure that those are all resolved? Or do you, or does it just happen?
That's a really good question. I hope they're resolved, or if they're not, that's intentional, by the way. I'm just thinking about like the different relationships. You know, most of what the book is like Rocky's relationships with the people she loves. Like that is sort of the heart of the book, and then her grappling with herself both physically and psychologically. I think I have a sense of those. Those are kind of included in those. I have like a, in that 1 through 25, sorry if this is too granular.
No, I love it.
In the 1 through 25, I have the plot thing that's like the Rocky reads her biopsy results or, you know, whatever the thing is. And then I have this other column that's like the other things that need to happen in that chapter, if that's what's happening in the chapter. And that's where I keep information about stuff that's like, Willa forgives her, you know, whatever other thing needs to happen. So I sort of track the plot, and then I also have a little other column that's just like seasonal details, and that I don't fill out super carefully, but like because this book moves from essentially Labor Day to New Year's, I just tracked a little before I started writing, like around when in that season things were going to be happening. You know, that's Halloween, it's Thanksgiving, it's the winter holidays, New Year's, and then it's going to be like the leaves are turning, the blackberries, the, you know,
yeah,
that kind of stuff.
It's so hard. Is it Tuesday?
Yeah.
Yeah. Dang it. If it's 4 days from the first day and the first day was a Thursday, that means it's Sunday, and Sundays do have a particular rhythm on their own. And yeah, no, it's so hard.
It's really hard, although that part's my favorite part, probably. Besides, I love dialogue, but I keep a lot of notes that are really dull on their own about like the weather and the landscape. Just in general, I don't even know what I'm going to use them for. I just keep a ton of notes about the seasons. And I love pilfering stuff for fiction from them because it's just like, it's going to be fairly accurate. Like, I will have dated it. I'll have a fairly strong sense of whether that'll work or not.
You're not going to put the blackberries in April.
And I'm not going to put the blackberries in April. And I have that cheater feeling of chunking in something I've already kind of written down. And then your word count goes up by like 300 words.
You're like, hey, I'm
and
done
you're
for
like,
the day.
Ah, daddy. Yeah. Yeah.
This is great.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my gosh, I love this. All right, well, one last question, and that is, what have you read recently where you felt like the writer was really, you know, playing big, doing their very max?
Yeah, I just read, I just got it in the mail, although my kitten, I want to show you, she has like chewed up every corner of it.
She had some fun with it, yeah.
So this book is A Truce That Is Not Peace by Miriam Taves, and she is a very, very favorite writer of mine. She wrote the novel All My Puny Sorrows that I always press on everybody because it's like the perfect, funny, sad novel. This book, I got to blurb, so I read it a while ago, and it just came, and I think it just came out maybe this week, I'm not sure. It's so incredibly good. It's really strange. She's doing some conference in Mexico, and that she has to write an answer to the question, why do I write?
Okay.
And she keeps starting and stopping, and it's nonfiction. I mean, it's just authentically this. And she includes like letters to her sister. Her sister killed herself some number of years ago, and that's the event that All My Puny Sorrows, which is a novel, is based on. But this, I'm under the impression this is the first time she's written about it
in a nonfiction way.
Yeah. And it is just, I did that thing, you know when a book is so good, I picked it up because I knew I was going to talk to you about it. And then I read it for like an hour.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Even though I've like already read it, it's so moving and beautiful and so like she's just struggling in this like really profound way to process loss and to understand herself and what she's created in the world, and it's so good.
It sounds huge, and I would, yeah, I'm gonna pick it up. I have a funny story about All My Puny Sorrows, which is that I took it to Spain while I was waiting for one of those patient portal things. I had cancer at the time, And the character of the sister who wanted to kill herself made me so angry that I had to hide. Not only did I have to leave the book behind, I had to hide it in the hotel so it would not juju me. I obviously survived because this was, I think, 7 or 8 years ago. But I couldn't, like, I just, it was, but that actually speaks to the power of the book. It's not that it wasn't an amazing book. It was that I literally couldn't handle the particular, mental illness that the sister was struggling with when I, you know, did not really want to die. Did not want to die. Yeah. So she's amazing. A really powerful writer.
That is a really powerful story. Wait, were you going to share with me a book? Or it doesn't work that way?
well, it doesn't
KJ
work
looks
that
around.
Way because I did not prepare.
What are you writing, KJ? What are you working on? What's happening?
All right. We're going to call this as an episode because it was excellent. And then I'm going to answer Catherine's question, which all of you listeners kind of vaguely know. Let's just say I'm trying to play big. All right. So this is me ending with thank you so much, Catherine Newman, for joining me on the Hashtag AmWriting podcast.
Thank you, KJ. It was a pleasure, as always.
And for all you listeners, we're still saying it. Keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Thank you.